Well, hello everyone, and welcome to this webinar on gaining support from your team, elected officials, and the public for important projects in your communities. This is brought to you by the ICMA coaching program. We're delighted to have the strong support of the coaching program from ICMA RC, who is the platinum sponsor and proud supporter of this program. ICMA RC recognizes the everyday heroes like you, who continue to make our communities great. ICMA RC, building public sector retirement security. We also have gold sponsors, ICMA and CalICMA, and we're delighted to have 29 states across the country that are active as coaching partners with us in identifying topics like this, presenters such as today's presenters, and helping in getting the word out about the program. So we're delighted to have so much support and activity across the profession. We also have 9 outreach partners that assist us in reaching a diverse and inclusive audience, which is an aspiration for ICMA overall and of the coaching program in particular. So we thank you all for helping to make this program a success. I want to just speak very briefly about what you're going to be receiving today. The whole topic here is, how do you manage to move forward important initiatives in your community? And what can people at any level in an organization do to help that be successful? So we hope that you've come as a team, or that you'll take back this message to your team and be an inclusive one of how they can help engage and be productive in this effort. To assist us in this, we've got a star panel here. We've got Paul Casey, who's has 21 years of experience with the City of Santa Barbara. He's worked in community development, public works, and other areas where you get big projects and you have big challenges of moving them through, getting support for them to happen. He has a master's degree in public affairs from the University of Texas at Austin. And he's going to be talking about the challenges that they faced in getting support from their community around the whole topic of infrastructure and infrastructure improvements. So a lot of lessons to be learned from that situation. We'll be moving then to Anthony Lyons, who's city manager in Gainesville, Florida. They've been recognized by Fast Company magazine for really being at the cutting edge of creating the new American city. He's going to talk with you about that, how they use that as a vehicle for getting support for things that they're doing by making a very citizen-centered organization and way of engaging with their community and reimagining how local governments can function. We're then going to move to Hannes Zacharias, who is currently the professor of practice in the public administration program at the University of Kansas. You can see his KU insignias behind him. We sometimes call him the KU whisperer here. But he has a lot of experience both in Kansas and in Missouri as a city manager, and most recently as a county manager for Johnson County, Kansas, and as president of the National Association of County Administrators. He's going to be sharing with you 3 different scenarios about circumstances that have arisen in his career and experience, both on the project side, how to get support on projects, and also how to create a culture that can stimulate and support projects as they go forward. So I've got a great set of panelists. We're delighted that they've invested the time and energy with me in helping to produce and develop this webinar for you today. So we always like to get a read on how well we're doing in stimulating activity and engagement for our audience here. So we're going to put out a polling question here on how many people are at the end of the line there in your group. We welcome everybody, but we especially encourage groups because we find for each additional person who's there, there's a geometric improvement in the engagement and adoption of ideas and the modification of them as appropriate for the communities that are out there. So again, if you have questions along the way, I encourage you to type them in with the question function. We always welcome those, and we're pleased to have your questions along the way as we want to be of service to you throughout this session. Again, if you connected with us just recently, I want to highlight to you that the PDF of the presentation materials available in the handouts, and you'll also be getting an email after the session about the availability of the digital recording and of the PowerPoint. PowerPoint materials and final polling question results for our audience. So let's take a look at our audience here. We see that, 84% of you are there on your own, the rest of you in groups of varying sizes, upwards of 10 in some instances. So we're delighted to have each and every one of you here with us today. So let me set up our next, our first presenter, Paul Casey, and just getting that lined up here. Okay, well, Paul, we're so glad to have you today, and thank you for sharing your story of both challenges and setbacks, as well as success in gaining support for a project.
Good. Well, thank you very much, and thank you, everyone, for joining. I just want to start out being based in California along with Don, just to express heart goes out to what's going on in California from both a natural disaster standpoint and what happened in Thousand Oaks. We experienced a very traumatic natural disaster as well in December and January, and I know how personally and professionally difficult it is and the pressure we feel as professionals in public sector. And at the same time, that's the time we need to step up and lead and respond and help the community recover and get through the disaster. So I just want to start with that as a Californian. But let's get going. I want to talk a little bit about our sales tax measure. We identified the need for getting a sales tax measure done for infrastructure. Like many communities, we've had infrastructure needs going back to 1999 when we tried to replace the public safety, the police station, with the bond measure that didn't pass, but it was already undersized in 1999. Like so many of us, we were falling behind in our ability to keep up with our streets and roads. That's a national issue that everyone's facing. And then we're a city that really built a lot of community buildings in the 1920s, 1930s. And so they're hitting a 100-year lifespan and need major reinvestment as well. And we just weren't able to carve out a substantial amount of money out of our existing operating budget to address it. So we needed to look at different options. And like many communities, when you're looking at revenue options, you look at a lot of different options to see what fits best for the needs at the time and what works with your community. So back in 2006, 2007, we started having the dialogue. Do you look at a sales tax increase? Do you look at a bed tax increase? Do you look at a parcel tax, a general obligation bond, or certificates of participation? All good standard revenue-raising options that local governments generally have available to them. I will say in California, if you're looking for kind of an ongoing revenue stream of the most substantial amount, you tend to land on sales tax. It's the most broadest base tax, gets you the most revenue at a politically palatable increase in size. If you're looking at a more targeted, just a single project or something, you might want to look at one of those other options as well. But, you know, you can work with your finance staff and just kind of crunch the numbers. You know kind of what's the feasible range you might look at, and you can see what kind of revenue stream you get out of each and every one of those. So for Santa Barbara, we love our public process. And so in 2007, we went to the city council and talked about this issue, and they suggested that we create a citizens task force. And so we went out and recruited and council appointed members to serve on the task force. It was a good task force in the sense that it wasn't any of the usual suspects that we deal with. These were folks who were successful businessmen, retired business people, into the area, real estate brokers and others that just kind of brought a different perspective and a fresh look. And so we worked with them over a year, looking at our infrastructure needs, talking about the issues, and they compiled this report, which had a number of recommendations. The key takeaways were, yes, we had a funding shortfall, and the city government should try to make itself leaner to carve out more revenue to go into capital, and should consider a half-cent sales tax to try to address the issue. I don't know if you can see, but at the very bottom, the report was issued in October of 2008. And if you recall what was going on in October of 2008, the stock market was starting to take a nosedive, and that was the very beginning of the major economic recession that we all hit nationwide. So timing couldn't have been worse to talk about carving more revenue out for infrastructure. And in fact, the recommendation to thin the organization, we needed to thin the organization to offset the loss of revenue from the recession. So they were right that we could be a little bit leaner, but we used it up to rebalance our books. So that was unfortunate that the timing on that was as bad as it was. So you got to live with it for a while. And that's one of the takeaways I want you to think about, is being persistent towards a project. And so that was a setback, kind of had the wind taken out of your sails. So for the next 4 to 5 years, we kept the issue on the front burner by just taking every opportunity we could to highlight that our most critical need as a city organization was meeting our unmet infrastructure needs. That meant every budget message that we sent forward each year with the city budget. It meant every state of the city presentation that we make, every chamber event that we go to. Every time we get the question of what are the biggest issues facing the city, we would lead with, we need to find a way to fund our unmet infrastructure needs to maintain the quality of a city that Santa Barbarans expect. So keeping the issue alive was important in the front burner. Then in 2015, I got a slow network connection there, Don. Can you fast forward maybe for me?
I think we're there.
There we are. Thank you. Sorry about that. So we fast forward and 2015, we put together a council subcommittee. One of the other things I want you to think about is you need to take in context of what's going around you in the community. We have a number of other governmental agencies that were looking to raise revenue as well. And the last thing you wanted to do is put two measures on at the same time with competing entities and have you both fail. We're all in this together. And so supporting your school districts and city college districts is important as well. So we kind of had during this time frame a couple other ballot measures that were floating out there. City College didn't pass theirs. That was pretty surprising. Usually the community is very supportive of education. So that was interesting in that regard. I got to get back. So then we created the council subcommittee, which I mentioned, and put them on a roadshow. And we had them out meeting with the community and going out and meeting with your chamber groups, your rotary groups, and others. One of the interesting takeaways with that was to put council kind of in charge of that. We put a presentation together for them. We helped them get talking points and stuff, but we put them out on the roadshow, not city staff. And that was effective in that it forced them to get more entrenched in the issue and understand it better. It put them out front and showed the community that this is a serious issue, that council members were kind of leading this community dialogue and discussion. So oftentimes, it's planning staff or public works staff that's out engaging. And so that was effective. And we did informational mailers and such like that. We then got them to go with a, Don, why don't you just start forwarding for me? I'm struggling here, or it's slow connection on my end. I apologize. We were successful in getting them to do a poll. It was the first time that they were willing to spend the money and take the little political heat of doing a polling presentation. And so we did that. And the poll results came back quite successful. 64% in support of a half-cent sales tax increase with a 20-year sunset clause. So we are excited. We're good to go. We prepare all the information. We're ready to place the item on the November ballot. We need 5 votes out of 7 to place it on. We only got 4 votes in support. So this is another takeaway, is that sometimes in our profession, politics comes into play, and there's often not a lot we can do about it. And it's just something we have to be cognizant of, work with, and try to do the best with. We had a mayor who was running for an open congressional seat, and she was competing with the county supervisor who was also running for that congressional seat, and it divided the local Democratic Party, and that included council members as well. And so we had some council members who supported the county supervisor who didn't want the mayor to get this feather in her cap of solving the infrastructure issue, and so they came up with reasons why they weren't comfortable going forward in this election cycle with the item. So that was a setback. Something we didn't really foresee happening and something we had to deal with. So what we did is we referred the issue to the Finance Committee. Again, don't stop, don't give up, kind of keep plugging away. So we referred it to the Finance Committee. They had 10 meetings, very intense meetings, going over every issue and looking at every possible option that they could do. One of the advantages of taking a little longer time is it allowed you to increase the way we communicate to the public. And so we created different mechanisms to show our information. And one of them is this graphic coming up here. that showed over 20 years, if we invest continuing at $2 million per year, these are the number of streets that could be covered by that level of investment into our streets. And compare that with if we were able to get a revenue measure and put in close to what we feel we need to invest in our streets, this is the level of coverage that you could get in pavement for your streets. So there's the broader coverage that you can get. So in presentations, you would toggle back and forth between those two and just kind of show the stark reality of if we want to invest and have quality streets, we got to step up and put the money into it. The other advantage of going to the Finance Committee allowed us to dig pretty deep into a number of other areas besides the obvious ones of a police building and streets and roads. And so we were able to talk about fire stations, storm drains, parks facilities, flood control, accessibility needs, and put together that really comprehensive everything under the sun that we need to be investing in that we just don't have the revenue to do. And it just kind of overwhelmed people that, you know what, we really are behind the eight ball here and we need to step up and figure a better way to do this. So we got a second poll done. So now we're heading into the election of November 2017. We're on odd year elections. And one of the things that we did is we were able to show that the estimated cost of infrastructure needs were approximately $400 million over 20 years. And that would take at least $20 million per year to hit that need. And that a half cent sales tax would raise about $10 million a year. So another thing we need to do as professionals is sometimes just kind of get in people's ears and say, what if? You know, if we really want to solve this, we might need to think about a full set. And so that was kind of a big deal. The community and council was always focused on a half cent. You show them that close to half of the other cities in California, when they go for revenue measures and sales tax increases, have been going for a penny, so it's not out of the norm. And just kind of laid out the stark reality. Look, if we go for a half cent, we can either build a police building or we could solve our police and or solve our streets and roads. But you're not going to be able to do both. If you can do a full cent, you're going to be really darn close to doing both. And so we did another poll, like I said, and we included the full 1 cent as an option to that polling effort. And what came back and kind of surprised us is that the 1 cent polled better than a half cent. And having no time period on it polled better than having a 20-year sunset clause. We did a focus group as part of that polling, and what we learned from that is they said, look, if you're going to come to us and want to solve a problem, let's solve it. Let's do it right. And so we went forward with a 1 cent sales tax, and we got it passed last November, passed with 57% of the vote. And one of the things we were able to do just before going and placing it on the ballot is we were able to put together a really good informational piece that you can give to the voters. It's legal to do before the campaign starts, and so that's why you always want to get good fact pieces out on the street before you place a measure on the ballot. So we did that. It's a really professional-looking presentation, showed the need, compared at the bottom where our sales tax was to other communities. And so that was really important. We're the red line down on the bottom. So we're at the lower end compared to other cities that we normally compare ourselves with. The Santa Monicas, the Palm Springs, Santa Cruz, Palo Altos of the world. Even with a 1 cent sales tax, we'd kind of be in the middle range. And so that just kind of showed that we need to step up. We need to fund infrastructure like other communities we're talking about doing. So some key takeaways from all this effort. One is be accurate. You need to build trust that when you're asking for money that you're going to be professional and spend that money appropriately. And so that is knowing the issue and being accurate and concise in what you're talking about. Be thorough. Be consistent. That goes to all of your department heads and council members. Be consistent with your messaging and what the reasons are. Be accessible. Be persistent, which has clearly been a theme, and be strategic. Some other key to presenting the topic successfully, be patient, build support, be thorough and accurate, talk about the need. We talked about those. Find leadership within the council. This is something that's going to be unique to everyone who pursues something like this. I'm dealing with seven council members, and they bring different strengths and different opportunities to the table. The mayor at the time was a very effective person at communicating. She was effective at running campaigns and raising money. You needed the mayor on board. At the same time, you needed that council member on board who supported the other candidate in the congressional race. And there's hard feelings there. And they didn't particularly want to work together, but they had to. If this was going to work, you needed your two smartest, most politically astute people working together to get this over the finish line. And to their credit, they both stepped up and they did that. But part of that was an ask. It was a direct ask saying, I need you both and I need you both to work together. And they said yes, and I'll always be thankful for them for doing that. You need to find leadership and community partners. Fortunate for us, the Chamber of Commerce was very supportive of this measure. And so that gave a broader sense of support to have the business community behind you. Build trust with the community. That you just got to earn that over time. You just have to earn that trust so that when the day comes when you need to go for a big ask, you've built that trust up. And you need to be politically astute. We talked about that, about being aware of what's going on around you in other areas and how to work with councils and what's kind of going on behind their scenes and their political mind that we don't always see in our professional role. And then finally, productive change. Everyone has to be on board or not strongly opposed. To his credit, I had a council member who was conservative, was never going to vote for a tax increase. He ran for mayor during this election. He ran against the sales tax increase. To his credit, he always prefaced his opposition by saying, I get the need. We need to invest more in our infrastructure. I just don't think the sales tax is the right way to go. You can live with that kind of opposition. When the opposition is acknowledging the need, that's okay. He was running for the 35% who were never going to vote for a tax increase anyways. And so that was all right. But the fact that he did it civilly and respectfully really helped garner the campaign to go well. Staff, you need to be unified and on board. And that's your executive management team. They need to speak with one voice and be consistent on their messaging. But inform the rest of your organization, whether you're a big organization or small. People in the community on weekends are going to ask your employees what's going on and what's up with this. Give them enough information that they can speak knowledgeably about the need and what the issue is. That's really important. Support from elected officials, support from the chamber, and then build accessible, be accessible and build trust with the media. That's really important as well and happens over time. But it comes into play. They set the tone of stories. They set the discussion of the needs. They set the angle they're going to take. And if you've built trust over them over the time, that can help you in the long run. Building trust just means answering their phone calls. They're on deadline. Respect that they've got a job to do and, you know, be professional and help them do their job. And that just pays dividends in the end. If you're a small city, I'll wrap up with a small city. You may not have the resources to do as big a campaign and stuff. I'll use the example of Carpinteria to the south of us. They're a city of 9,000 people, about 10 miles away. They watched our lead. They watched us go, and they watched us be successful. And now a year later, they've put their measure on the ballot and say, we've got the same issues as Santa Barbara up the street. We want to keep our libraries open, and we want to pave our roads better. And in fact, we're not going to go for a penny. We're going to go for a penny and a quarter. So they got that pass. But they were able to kind of build on, hey, you know, the big city up the road really recognized this. We've got similar issues. And then they just kind of piggyback on that support and say, if Santa Barbara can support it, so can we. So that's an option for small cities to do as well. And with that, that concludes my presentation. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, Paul, that's very helpful. And thank you for the suggestions for small cities, because I know we have lots of small agencies that participate in these webinars and want to be sure that they're being well served by them as well. And that was a very helpful takeaway for them. Yeah. Use the comparisons. It sounds like that was very powerful for your peer group and it was very powerful for Carpinteria as a contrast. So that's wonderful. So, Paul highlighted some areas that your agency could take some action in helping to gain support. We're interested in your thoughts about where you think it would be valuable to give more attention in the kinds of efforts that you have underway, whether it be a campaign for a tax increase or just a campaign to gain support for doing a project that you might already have funded, but getting it through and supported for people to encounter the change that happens. So we're interested in getting your feedback on that. We've gotten a lot of questions that have come in. First, there was a shout out for GIS maps. People were saying, hey, that was really powerful to be able to graphically show what the situation would be with and without the tax and how that worked out. And a bunch of other questions that have come in. People would love to get copies of your materials. Is there anything that you can, are they on your website in some way that we could you could share with me and that I could send out to the attendees if they're interested to, you know, get a little deeper into your material? I think a lot of people are saying, hey, this looks like a well-thought-out program. I'd love to, you know, see what we could do to create in our community a similar kind of campaign. Do you have anything along those lines, Paul, that you might share?
Yes, great question. We do. We had a dedicated site on our webpage with all of the information, presentations, PowerPoints, staff reports that we put to council. We put that all on our infrastructure webpage. And so I'll forward that to you, Don, and you can forward that to people. But that was an effective strategy. It was very transparent. If people had questions, we could refer them back to the webpage and, you know, look at the PowerPoints and that sort of stuff. So yes, we'll definitely get that link to you and happy to share all the information that we have.
Okay. Well, I can see that many of the areas that you identified, Paul, were ones that rang true for our audience and areas that they would like to be giving more attention to in their organization. So thanks for stimulating that discussion. We have time for a couple, another quick question or two here. So they're wondering, you know, this is big, these are big projects, streets, everyone sees them. How do you look at gaining support for projects that maybe aren't as so present and visible, like regulatory compliance or things that need to be done internal to the organization, but, you know, might not otherwise get support? Do you have any quick thoughts or ideas about that one before we move on?
That's a good question, and that's an interesting one. You know, we had real good support from City Council about recognizing we need to reinvest in just kind of the basic buildings of the city, but that's not super sexy for the public to vote on. And so our strategy was you got to put a comprehensive package together, and you need the streets and roads and the police station to kind of carry that other stuff that you know you need to do. You need to be transparent and talk about the need, but I think if we just went out to say we need to fix up city municipal offices, not sure that was going to really ring excitement from the community. So that's where you got to be a little politically astute and politically strategic about how you put a full package together to address some of those maybe not as popular issues.
Okay. And we also got a question about your polling, advanced polling on these. An agency was describing that they've done polling before and they had trouble even getting people respond to a poll and feel that the polling results would be accurate and reflective of the community. Any quick suggestion you've got for how to get good polling information?
You know, that even the politics of getting a council to agree to a poll was very hard here at the city. You know, it took us a number of years for them to have the courage to spend $30,000 on a poll. You know, there's the question about whether polling's still effective or not. Seems to be. You know, our poll had us at 64%. We specifically ran a very quiet campaign because there was no organized opposition. So we drifted down a little bit and came in at about 58%. But I think polling is still showing to be effective. That's why you hire a professional pollster. That's why we did a focus group as well. You were able to dig in a little bit deeper with kind of just 30 people that you pulled off the street in three different small little focus groups and really kind of see where they were heading. So I would still recommend doing polling. It's good to know also what tests well. What's the messaging that's going to sell the most? Unfortunately, there's politics. And so you got to put a message together that's going to be successful if you're going and asking for voters for them to increase and raise some money. And so polling really helps you in that messaging going forward.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Paul, we'll get back to you as we have time at the end with other questions that'll be for all of our panelists. So we're moving now to Anthony Lyons. Anthony, we're so delighted to have your participation in this webinar to tell us about the new American city and what you're doing to engage your citizens in a new and different way to help build broad-based support for the things that you're trying to do in local government. Welcome. We're not hearing you, Anthony.
Yes, go ahead. Yep.
Thank you.
You hear me?
We can now. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thanks for the invitation. Thanks for everyone for listening. I'm coming to you live from Gainesville, Florida, which is a beautiful city located where the University of Florida is. I want everyone to know I started my career in New Hampshire in a town of just 12,000 people. My first budget was $80,000. I was the only employee. And so I just want you to think through how this applies to smaller cities. Some of these things are expensive, some are not, but the application can be done in any size city whatsoever. So, thank you. So today I'm going to cover three areas. I'd like to define the process. We had a quite a robust process for the Blue Ribbon Report, which I'll get into in a moment. Setting the new course, launching for all things citizen-centered and what that means for us. And then we'll round out with really the making of a new American city and how we define that. And then finally, we'll finalize with what things we can transfer to you that we learned here. This really started, and I'll go over a timeline in just a moment, a really simple question. The mayor at the time and commission asked us to think through really the very simple thing of how can the city become more competitive. Cities think of it in many ways. Often they do a SWOT analysis. They do various forms of Blue Ribbon reports. And they decide at the end of the day, usually to do some changes within city government. And many of them look the same. We looked across the country and I studied probably a dozen or two in most cities looked very, very similar. So we just started asking ourselves, if every city looks the same, how is it we can be more competitive with other cities? And the very question of being competitive for a city, we thought was really interesting. We didn't learn as much as we wanted to from other cities, and so we started looking at the private sector, looking at companies like Uber, the Ritz-Carlton, Nike, companies like that, and what was differentiating them and their business from everybody else. We landed with really a simple premise, which was that their user experience was much better than others. Think of Uber versus a taxi cab and the experience that you have in one versus the other. Best Buy is still around, Circus City is not. Apple user experience is easy, others were less so. And so we started really thinking about how to apply the user experience or citizen experience to everything that we do. Which brought us really to three really simple topics. Thinking of how to inspire both ourselves and others to dream big. It's not something that government likes to do, but something we really want to press ourselves and others to think about. Once we are inspired, we need to think through the design of both the government and the city itself. And so really thinking about the future and guiding questions, which we'll go over in just a moment. And then leading the movement, right? Taking on permission, not waiting for someone to say, go ahead, but really being inspired ourselves. And with the citizens to move forward in a particular direction. Once we decided that the user experience was something that we would really, and when I say user, I'm really talking about the citizen experience, making sure that we put the citizens at the center of everything that we do. We created this Blue Ribbon Report, which I have talked about. The very first thing was a get it done plan. Others may call it a strategic plan. We really found it very important to think about the work that we wanted to do, not from a strategic point of view, but from a citizen point of view. If you think about it, governments are often designed for the government. They're not often designed for the citizens or for the users. And so we wanted to really flip that. Part of what we did is to reach out to the citizens, and we had huge amounts of feedback across the board. I'll give you a timeline of how this all started at the next slide. So the committee was created to think about and promote the competitiveness in 2005. We actually were asked, and I stepped back, almost did a sabbatical from my position. I was the Community Redevelopment Agency Director at the time. So I did almost half time at that and half time setting up this committee. We appointed a board. The commission appointed a board of there are 25 or so individuals. By the way, the report is something that I can email anyone if they want. And we started with this, again, very basic question. We moved on once we figured out that we needed to learn about the private sector and how they did it, we partnered with a company called IDEO. Some of you may know IDEO from developing the mouse on your keyboard. They developed things like the stand-up toothpaste and many, many other things. I realized at that time period that there was a private sector company that was really at the forefront of doing really wonderful work. So we wanted to hire them to think about this kind of work. We actually, during that time period, opened up a retail storefront in our downtown to engage and think about the work with the community, together with the community, and co-designed with the community. I became city manager in December of 2015. I was not at the time. I was interim planning and development director. The Blue Ribbon Report was adopted in December of 2015. I hired one staff person to help us think through change number three, which is our Get It Done plan. We engaged, as you can see here, multiple workshops. We gathered about 450 ideas and 2,400 or so citizen connection points. These are one-on-one conversations and polling that we did with them. We then launched the Department of Doing, which we'll get into in a little bit, but we wanted to think through, if you redesign the government around a simple premise of thinking about things around the citizen, what does that look like from a department? And so we'll talk about the Department of Doing in just a moment. The strategic framework was adopted after that time period. And then a connection point, we launched what we call our front doors. So whenever someone walks into a physical space or digital space, how are they met, right? Think about the Ritz-Carlton or a wonderful hotel. They actually design the experience when you walk up to the front counter so that you're in a good mood. A lot of our spaces, you'll see ours in a moment, frankly, is not designed that way. And then a number of other digital components to make sure that folks really could experience our work in a really wonderful way. And I'll show you that in just a moment. So that was some of the process that we went through. Like every good strategic plan, every good thought process, we really wanted to utilize human-centered design, some call it design thinking, around the work that we wanted to do. And so we wanted to, there's a wonderful gentleman named Alan Weber who founded Fast Company Magazine. He's now mayor of Santa Fe, New Mexico. He would often say to me, a good question beats a good answer. So we wanted to ask good questions. Rather than saying a strategic plan is we're going to set out to do these four projects, we really wanted to figure out, number one, how to support a strong economy. Number two, how to foster greater equity. Number three, how to plan for a better future. Number four, how to become a community model for the world, the kind of thing that we're doing today. And within each of those, there's certain questions. If you don't have a question in mind, it's hard in our world, as you all know. Often we have a solution and we forget to ask a question, and then we back up the process to help answer that solution rather than asking the right question. This is the kind of thing we're going to be delving more and more deeply into with our community as time goes on. So that's a little bit about the process, a little bit of the guiding questions. But as many of you know, the government has to be rebuilt. It has to be rebuilt to be more citizen-centered. It has to be rebuilt then to have civic innovation. So what do I mean by that? Our governments have been designed and built over many, many, many years. And so to do any sort of change, even a small system change, takes a lot of work to do. So we had to both introduce a new user experience, a new citizen experience model, at the same time as really encouraging civic innovation and having a civic platform across the entirety of the organization. Both things individually are very new and very different. So we had to build both of these platforms while we are also moving forward in all the work that we're doing as a city. Something quite challenging to do. We could do a whole webinar on just that. We realized at that point, though, we're not alone. We have many great assets. We looked around the city and wanted to work first with people that wanted to work with us. The university and the city had, I would say, a fine but not wonderful relationship for many, many years. We really, in fact, in November, in February 14th, Valentine's Day of 2017, we signed a memorandum of understanding to work together in really a meaningful way. University of Florida is a top 10 research institution today. We also reached out and worked with Santa Fe Community College. the point of that, in part of the civic innovation system that we talked about just a second ago, was to get the brightest minds on campus, working with the brightest minds in the city, and actually work together on projects that would make meaningful change. So we last year launched about $350,000 worth of research grants. The university professor had to put in a research grant. It had to work with a department director, and they had to solve a local problem. So that work actually just finished. We're about to launch the second round. And we came up with ideas like, how do we reduce the amount of 911 calls? For us, it was testing out and piloting a process where the fire department, along with community health individuals, would go to someone's home and see what the issues were, rather than waiting for the 911 call. Again, we can forward some information about that, but we reduced 911 calls for that population by about 50%. I like this chart very much, and I think it's something that you can share with many people, but the whole idea of what citizen-centered or user-centered means. On the left is what the citizen experiences. Every day we have these things called moment of truth, right? You leave your driveway, the curb is owned by the city, the street, the trash, the stoplight, the stop sign, the lighting system, the bus system, right? Think of all those places that you touch the city on the way to work or home or school, whatever the case may be. So the citizen experiences actually on the left, all the service. But what the government mostly does is spend time all the way to the right on the policymaking. So you could spend a year or two or three figuring out a policy, and then those of us that have to implement and do the service spend a half a minute or two trying to figure out how best to implement this. So we think that you should either co-design them together or at least spend as much time on the service as you do on the policy to make sure the citizen experiences exactly what the policy should be like. And it's done in a real thoughtful manner. So as I said to you, we first hired IDEO to help us think through how to apply a system change to the entirety of government to one area. And so I happened to be at the Planning and Development Office at the time that I was also the executive director of the Blue Ribbon panel. And this was essentially my first day. This was the Planning and Development Office. You can see all the wonderful wayfinding signs. There was someone there that may even hide behind there. So this is the front door for all the permitting that we did across the city. Not the best experience. Can you imagine if this was a hotel that you were to stay in? This is the building counter. People turn to the back. These are actual shots. It's not the kind of experience that you would want. And frankly, again, being competitive, is this really the most competitive environment that you would enjoy? I think the next slide will prove it even best. This is a representative example of where you go to pay your bill, except our bars were all the way to the ceiling in that case. And so it literally went to a small cage. I couldn't find an actual photo of it. This is something very close to it. But you essentially went to a jail bar. There's about 10 square feet of someone standing there, and that's how you pay your bill. It's not great for the employee. It's certainly not great for the citizen. So again, we wanted to think about a new department and a new way of thinking. Here are six ideas that we came up with that could apply to any department, right? Both the citizen and the city worker shares a sense of purpose, right? We embrace it together. We are relationship-based, not transaction-based. If you think about it, we process a permit. We don't work on a relationship. We want to reverse that. Having an entrepreneurial mindset, it's very important to test and prototype and think of different ways. Make it modular. You know, the whole process sometimes is not working, but you can chunk it up and make sure that each component works really well. Show people where they are in the process. Often, as you all know, the easiest way to get lost is not know where you are. A lot of the government processes are very, it's a black box, you don't know where they go. And the final thing is empowering citizens to assist, work with us, and work together in meaningful ways. So we wanted to apply all that
to... So we're going to go right here. I'll interrupt you for a moment, Anthony. We're getting lots of interest in what you're presenting, but you've offered some very provocative ideas here. Let's get some feedback from our audience about which ones of these new ways to work sound intriguing to them. And while we're doing that and getting their responses, and you can click off on your responses as many as you would like, people are wondering a number of different things. They're wondering whether people with pets were included in the design. In other words, how far did you go in this design when oftentimes in local communities, the pets are have a high premium in people's valuation?
It's a great question. We design for folks that do not engage with us. You can either design for the expert or you can design for the first timer. And so we decide to design everything for the first timer. And if you design for the first time, meaning the first time you come in our building, if you will, then everyone else will be taken care of. So that building, that, and I'll show you some after photos in a minute, was not truly accessible for ADA. It was not a great environment where you could sit down with a city employee, forget about that, or with the contractor or other permit people that you're working with. And so we really thought about, and we talked to not people that showed up. In fact, we went out and looked for people that didn't engage with us. We did sort of cold calls to the various agencies across the community to find out how to open a business. And we were surprised to figure out that most people did not know how to open up a business. And I mean institutions. And so they would place you in many different areas. And so we spent 2 months, which doesn't seem like a lot of time, but we had five people from IDEO. We had a full-time staff of a few people and a number of us working day to day to interview many, many, many individuals and people that we would never see otherwise, going out to their businesses and talking to them in a very anthropological way, rather than hosting a meeting, saying everyone come, and then what typically happens, the same, you know, five or six people come, which is not a bad thing, but you don't get a variety of views. And so we really wanted to make sure to get a variety of views. So animals, not specifically, we didn't put them in or put them out, but we wanted to ensure that everyone was welcome.
Okay. We see from the polling results here that people are very interested in the idea of being relational rather than transactional. And I know you've got some illustrations of how you encourage that. And we're coming up on in just a moment, and embracing the shared purpose and empowering citizens at every interaction. So let's hear how you go about doing that and continue with the story.
Sure. So on the left-hand slide is what, that was literally my first day. And then what you see now is the same location several months later. I mentioned the Ritz-Carlton before. When you look at that now, you feel like you're walking into a Ritz-Carlton. It's a really wonderful space. This slide, if I can stand for just half a second, when you walk in, we have everything that a hotel would have. You have plants there. We actually have a water jug like you may when you first walk into a hotel. And we renamed the Planning and Development Department, the Department of Doing. Why did we do that? For a lot of reasons. Number one, people would take notice. When you want to change, the only way to change is to change. And having the same name and the same look and feel of the area would absolutely not do that. So what's the first thing that generally happens when you meet somebody? You say, what do you do? Right? I do X, Y, and Z. And so the name may be a little bit corny, but we really wanted to embrace a really different way of thinking about things. It's the DOD or the Department of Doing. And so all things that you need to get done, you can do in this particular location. We had a logo made also just for this department, which was different than some other areas. And then you see also, much like a fine hotel, these are local works of art. And then you can come and sit and have coffee, drink, meet people here. You can meet our staff there. You can meet your friends and family here. We have seen people pose for wedding and prom pictures here. If you can imagine those photos before, having people come in to take prom pictures or wedding pictures at that location, now people actually do this in a city building at the Planning and Development Department, now Department of Doing. Pretty incredible. And we didn't stop there. This is really a top-to-bottom change. We changed all the collateral material. We used very easy graphics. We got rid of all words necessary. We made sure it was really simple to use. Something like historic districts, as many of you know, is very, very hard. This is not an expensive thing to do. We also employed a lot of technology. we did something called a virtual building inspections. So contractors often, like the cable person, give you a moment, they'll come to your house between 12 and 4 p.m. We decided to take care of that. So if you have an AC inspection, as an example, you can now call us when you're there. We have a building inspector sitting at the desk at a computer. When the AC inspector calls us, they merely turn on their phone and FaceTime with us or Skype, show us the work, and we can approve without going there. It's very citizen-centered in the sense that you're not waiting 2 to 4 hours as a homeowner. You don't even have to be there. If the contractor goes and says, they only have to tell us when they're going to call. There's always someone there, and so they can do an inspection on the spot rather than waiting, and that helps efficiency on our side and the homeowner side. At the end of the day, it's this very kind of thing. Simplify and humanize absolutely every interaction between citizen and employees. I just gave you a great example of that. We have this item called a Grow It Yourself Business Kit. Rather than giving you a bunch of paperwork, this is really for you. It's a package that you can take with you while you're trying to start a business. And it's just one of the many, many examples of the kinds of things that we are trying to do. So what we learned. Some items are quote unquote cheap. Some items are not. There's a range of things. But think of innovation and think of ways of making the experience much, much better. If something doesn't work, dial it back a little bit. It's okay to make a mistake. I know in our world, sometimes people don't want to, but it's absolutely okay. Yes, internal systems have to change. It's just the way it is. You can't change an organization and have a better experience unless you decide to change everything else. Having a vision and a sense of direction matters. And I don't mean a vision and mission statement, which are typical things. I mean, what's the movement you're trying to create? How are you trying to make the city into a much better place? It's not always a series of things that you do. It is an experience. People go to a game for the experience. Yes, it's for the game, but it's year round. If it wasn't just for the experience, you would watch it at home. So having a great vision and experience matters in a vision. And then having lots of creative people and having people think about systems. There are some folks, it's fine, that need to just go do some work. And there are some folks that need to really think through how an area affects another area, affects another area. It's much more than an org chart. It's really about how you think about things in a really different way. Our biggest lesson, and I think we did not start with this particular place, is that the city has no brand. No city has a brand. If you think of all the best cities besides Gainesville, think of the cities you know around the world. You don't know them for a logo. You don't know them for a tagline. You know them for their people and their place. It's not a symbol or a seal. It's the stories of a place. It's the values of the city. And it's the feeling and experience you have. And so if you see behind me, we actually debranded and unbranded the entirety of the city. There's no, our logo, if you will, does not say city of. It says Gainesville. It says people empowered, citizen centered. And why we did that, it really breaks down the lines of government and people so that it's a collective. And we think it was a very important thing to do. And finally, here's my contact information. You have it here. You can certainly email me in whatever way that you want. I do want to just end on a note, which is to say our work can sometimes be a challenging one. You all know being inspired, inspiring your staff, inspiring the community and elected officials that keep driving huge change forward is really important. All great work is hard. All great work is important. All hard work is important. You generally know, and I generally know, when things get tougher, we know we're on the right road. Often I say to folks, the size of your adversary will determine your size of your success. And so if you have no adversary and people really don't care, it probably means you're not pushing enough. We have lots of studies, lots of articles on this and many more topics. If anyone's interested, you can certainly email me or Don or the case may be. And I thank you for sharing some time.
Well, Well, this is super information, and we've gotten a lot of responses in here, Anthony, with people being very interested in these materials. So what I'm going to suggest, just to avoid everybody having to repeat the same task, is there's going to be an automatic email going out with the digital recording and the other information available from this session. And I'd ask you if you could send me today the links on your website to the relevant materials, the Blue Ribbon report that you mentioned, you know, maybe your 911 study that shows a practical example, and anything else that you have along those lines that people could dial into. I think that'll be the most efficient way for us to serve the audience here and get everybody, you know, finding some things that they can launch into. Let me go to a polling question here. Anthony shared with you a number of sort of lessons learned, and it's important to think about, you know, which ones you believe would be helpful for your agency. So let's take a look at those and click off as many as you feel would be helpful lessons to apply in your agency context, so we can see those. People had a number of questions, and I think you alluded to this a little bit at the end here, the size of your adversary equals the size of your success. What blowback did you get on this, and how did you handle it?
It's a great question, and you know, you get quote-unquote blowback often on many, many items. The first thing we did is that when we first started down this road, the board was made up of many individuals from across the community. Even more important than that, when we hired IDEO, we had funding from the University of Florida, from the hospital system, the builders, the realtors, the chamber, the economic development organization, the city, all working together, not knowing what the answer was going to be. But when you have everyone funding together, everyone needs to embrace the answers at the end of the process. And so we were able to, I think, quite thoughtfully work with people during the beginning of the process to ensure that people were on board, at least with the idea. Now, today, if something doesn't go right, of course, everyone says, oh, I thought you were citizen centered. Well, it doesn't mean we're not, and doesn't mean we're not trying, but we're now 3 years into this. This is a long-term effort. There are many, many things to design and redesign, and it takes some time. And as I said at the beginning, it's doing the day-to-day work while we're doing this. And so organizing and reorganizing an organization around these principles takes some effort. And so I think we're doing a great job, but there's a lot of work to do. And every time something doesn't go well, we hear about it, but that's fine. It keeps us on our toes.
Okay. Well, we've got a bunch of additional questions coming up, and we're going to cover those at the end. But I do want to note here that we had some really interesting results on the polling, and just to have those up for people to see. A lot of interest in the internal systems and preparation of those, so we'll be getting back to that a little bit later. Hannes also has some ideas and insights from his experiences as well to share on that, as Paul may is in addition. And everyone needs to think creatively, and that's a really important topic. We're going to cover more questions about the elements here of this a little bit later, but let's proceed now with our presenter, Hannes Zacharias from Kansas. Hannes, we're so glad that you're with us here today, and look forward to your message about practical applications in three different contexts of gaining support in projects.
Well, thanks, Don. I really appreciate it, and nice to be part of this activity. I'm kind of the anchor leg here, and the principles I'm going to bring forward here as we talk about this, I think, are those ideas that I think work in many different areas. I've been a city manager in a small community of 7,000, and also had the fortune to be a county manager for a population of 600,000 and institution of almost 4,200 people. So as we talk about this and how to really kind of find ways to get buy-in, if you will, from the team, the governing body, and the community, I think these are most fundamentally leadership issues and not management issues. When you talk about those, I think this kind of rubric, as I would bring forward here, works in any of those cases, in my viewpoint, and reinforces, I think, the great work that Paul and Anthony have been talking about as well. And I think some of the key points here is that whatever issue you want to go ahead and do, is defining the problem, really asking the right questions, is really a key. Because how you define the problem or the opportunity dictates then how you're going to solve those activities. Second of all, I think we in the profession spend a great deal of time talking about the what and how, but ignore the why. Why is it important that among the thousands of things that our community, our organization, our governing body are dealing with, that this particular issue deserves the paramount attention? And explaining why I think is very important for leadership. The idea of consulting individuals as we go allow other individuals to be part of this process, to share in the success, what Likert would call basically System 3 and System 4 thinking that we learned about in school and those sort of activities. Next, I think applying what Stephen Covey talks about for the 7 habits of highly effective people, those number 6 really kind of work at working those things to keep going. Be proactive, begin with the end in mind, that vision IQ idea, do the heavy work, think collectively and collaboratively, try first to understand and to be understood by whoever the constituency is. And then finally, I think as Collins would talk about, is using the hedgehog mentality, sticking with it. And I think you've heard basically from Paul and Anthony about the need to do that as well. So the way I'd like to try to do that is to kind of give you some ideas that might work it in terms of 3 different stories or examples. And that'd be the Caseworker Resource Center trying to help caseworkers really get more information and help coordinate work among various clients that we have, mutual clients in Johnson County. Creating a high-performance culture in the organization is the second story. And the third is developing community support for a $200 million courthouse expansion and a medical examiner facility as we go through it. And I think before I go into the story about the Caseworker Resource Center, what we're trying to reinforce is in the leadership component that leadership is getting people to do what you want them to do because they want to do it. Now, that is a quote from Dwight Eisenhower, and since he's a favorite son here, in Kansas, we kind of quote him on a regular basis. And so that's kind of the end result, the beginning result of this presentation. As we talk about the Caseworker Resource Center, here was the problem. When I came into Johnson County 18 years ago, I was in charge of mental health, public health, corrections, a myriad of human services departments. And it dawned on me that indeed we are not being very good and efficient in terms of sharing our materials to make sure that clients were being treated in a way that actually encouraged them to get out of the system, if you will. So I defined the problem as saying the coordination of human services is disjointed, decreasing mutual clients' ability to be self-sufficient. The next thing is talking about the opportunity is to bring forward the clinic approach to human delivery service problems, but how do we do that in a virtual environment was really kind of the challenge. And this was manifested by some activities in the state of Kansas where we had one individual who had as many as 15 to 18 different case management plans, sucking out hundreds of thousands of dollars of resources because we are not coordinated. So we put together a team, and the team basically said, Hannes, do you want to go ahead and do this? This is the idea of saying, you know, why is it important? We want to be efficient with how we deliver services to make sure that those who are mutual clients get the services they need. And the idea of talking about how do we change activities and go through to allow the people to be part of the process, consulting. And I consulted with the team said, well, that's great, Hannes. And we talked about we're going to enfranchise the work from various caseworkers. But the first thing we need to find out and prove to caseworkers is that they actually have some benefit of doing a process, if you will, in a computer-based process. How about we show our proof of concept by bringing in information from the 311 system, 211 system, sorry, to talk about where human services are delivered in the region, in the Kansas City region. So we said, okay, we'll develop this system and see if that will provide some efficacy. And that worked out to be tremendously beneficial. Now we have a system put in place. If you want to find out in this case where food pantries are, or diapers can be dispensed, or transportation tickets, or housing, or so forth, we put those up there, and you can inquire from that information. You then can take that information and look at the website to find out what the current requirements to go ahead and be part of that activity and eligibility, et cetera. We then put that information onto a map that shows about what they're all locations, but that wasn't good enough. The map then had to go and be more specific to say, I need to go into a certain location for certain activities. We said, okay, we'll develop that kind of mapping activity. But what about transportation? How does transportation work? So we said, we'll put a mapping, combine that to our mapping system, and we can show the client how to get to the food pantry vis-a-vis the transportation system and the times available so they can increase their success to go ahead and make that work. We said that's great and all good, but the real issue here is to go ahead and say, how do we go ahead and coordinate services between clients? How do we share mutual client information to be most effective with our clients? So the first part, really kind of the idea of saying morphing the vision, if you will, trying to go ahead and manage clients collectively, had to have some stutter steps. We had to prove the concept that caseworkers actually could rely upon a database system that would help them. The next part talks about how can we develop a caseworker system to share mutual client data in a HIPAA-protected environment. And we embedded that activity as well. So what you have now, basically, is where you have a system that's HIPAA-protected. You put in your client's name, and you find out what indeed other departments have that same mutual client. In this case, the names have been hidden to protect those for HIPAA requirement activities. But you can see the left portion there, the red flags indicate mutual clients. That allows individuals to go ahead, caseworkers, to now coordinate that case plan with somebody else so that, Hannes, an example here, might go to get a urinalysis at 3 o'clock at one location, and then we bring in the services as well to that person to go ahead and get perhaps some public health information to them, apply for housing, and those are added activities. We've also kind of put in place that the system connects together with the criminal justice system, so you know if indeed this person has a record with which you're dealing. That's important because we had a situation several years ago in Johnson County where we had deployed a mental health worker. And the mental health worker went into the client's home. Unbeknownst to her, this person had a very long criminal record, and she ended up getting murdered by the gentleman. So that created more anxiety, if you will, for this whole process. I want to, before I go on the next example, which talks about the culture, I want to let you know that this whole system we just talked about was done by virtue of allowing people to be involved in this process at no additional cost. We used our existing personnel, we used our existing GIS system to go ahead and do some things differently, and we invented that system. So again, that reinforces the idea of saying, identifying the problem, trying to understand why it's important, soliciting that information from a larger team, allowing your vision to morph, if you will, and then do the heavy lifting. You've got to work at it, morph at it, and stick with it over the long haul. The second example is talking about a culture of high performance in Johnson County government. And the real issue there was talking about that during the recession, reality is we could no longer be siloed organizations. We had to find ways to develop trust among the departments and share resources in an organization of 4,200 people. We had to reduce the organization by 12% and ongoing resources by $47 million. So we wanted to go ahead and develop a culture of that kind of mutual collaboration. So what did we do? We identified the problem. I then went off to the Senior Executive Institute in the University of Virginia and got educated about high-performance organizations and what it entails. And we had to go ahead and kind of develop some of that information because we knew that, indeed, engagement for employees is huge. That's a big deal. And the results activity is some hissing back here. The results are that, indeed, it becomes really important to engage employees in this day and age because of this graph. About only 30% of our employees are actively engaged, but almost 20% are actively disengaged in the organizations. And that does a huge amount of productivity, taking energy out of the equation, if you will. Numbers will look better here as far as you employee engagement trends will look better in the last few years, but still a large number that indeed are actively disengaged as we go forward. That is also part of the process when we talk about the ideas of trying to reinforce what Daniel Pink talks about, autonomy and mastery and purpose helps really energize employees. We try to heed that notion. We then did a more collective learning. We did this activity trying to understand really what is the nature of people. So again, our management philosophies come into play. And we had to sit down as an executive leadership team of about 30 people and really talk about if we're trying to change the culture of the organization, what do we feel about people really? Do we think people are basically idiots and are willing to go in to rip us off at every corner, or do we trust them to go ahead and do the right thing for the right reason for the public good? And we had to kind of re-educate ourselves that way. We had to understand how HPO really works. Where are we going? How do we get there? What culture propels us? How do we work together? All those fundamental strategies had to come forward as we try to go ahead and make things develop. We had to invent for ourselves what high-performance organizations look like in terms of understanding that performance is driven by a myriad of policies and procedures, but really what drives those is our culture, our vision and values, and you heard that before today, how important vision really is and values to change the culture. And understanding that this cultural change, in our view, takes between 5 and 7 years to go and make any appreciable change as we go forward. This was reinforced by work that we had, again, from the University of Virginia, understanding how work has changed over the last 100 years, from basically one that was an agriculturally based economy, now to the industrial phase, and now to the kind of information age where people are very well educated. How do we put them together in teams that actually work in solving problems on a regular basis? We understood that some of the activities we had to make sure that we had our skill level up, we had to learn about again what Lencioni calls the five dysfunctions of team, and really kind of putting those into play, trying to make sure that our team behavior is more team behavior than it is work group behavior. In my experience, there are a lot of work groups, but very few teams out there. So how do we develop a culture where the team mentality really comes in place, where we care about one another, we care about the common purpose, and trying to make those things happen? We had to reinvent what we talk about our leadership philosophy. What do we really believe about leadership in this organization? For an organization of almost 4,000, we adopted this philosophy that says leadership is the responsibility of all, not just by the management individuals. And we trust individuals to do the right thing for the right reason for the public good. And toward what purpose? For our viewpoint, the purpose is the HPO mantra, which is the Athenian Oath. And for those of you who may not remember, the Athenian Oath was the oath that people had to take in Athens before they could lead, which basically says they will leave the community not only not worse, but better than they found it going forward. And we really believe in that philosophy. So what are the results of that activity during the downturn? What I was really surprised about is trying to enfranchise the organization, trying to have to laying out the problem and issue to them, to consulting with the employees about the problem to reduce the organization by $47 million and 12% employee population, having them have input in how we then reduce the budget during that process. And we then did a reevaluation, as we do on an annual basis, about the community support. I was amazed that our community support, even though we reduced our organization by some 4,000 employees, our acceptance rate, or if you will, our viewpoint from the community, citizen satisfaction rates went up. And they went up in almost all categories, which was amazing to me, particularly in the area of the quality of customer service, which proved to me the concept about saying if we can enfranchise and lead people to be part of this effort collectively and collaboratively, they're willing to go ahead and make some sort of change. They're much more willing to go ahead and provide really good customer support as we go in the future. So that's the third.
Just to interrupt for a second here, Hannes, because you're presenting a lot of information. It's really very valuable, and I can see people are eager to learn more about it. Could you just very quickly give a sense of what was the time frame over which you did the high performance organization work, and did you access outside resources, or did you basically take the learning that you gathered from the Senior Executive Institute and go forward?
Good questions. We actually have been embarking upon that work for the last 7 years. It started when it came on board in 2008, 2009, so they're still developing that activity. We did two things. We invested resources by sending the department personnel to the University of Virginia and still do on a regular basis. We then invented for our own self, our own curriculum, to make sure that all 4,000 employees have access to all the information we had. We put together a 5-day training program that we indeed had our own department heads become the faculty on, and devoted a great deal of time and resources to do that. We couldn't afford to bring in outside consultants, organization of our size, that's not sustainable. So we trained ourselves to be trainers and understand the material and teaching it. And the blessing of that is twofold. First of all, because we saved money in that process. And second of all, the employee cynicism went down. Employees are very, very smart, and they understand that if this just becomes the flavor of the month, they'll ride it out for the next 5-6 years until the administration changes. Whereas having department heads do it, they got the real feeling and still do have the feeling that this is really meant to last, if you will.
Okay, great. Well, I know you want to have time here for your last example, and then we've got a bunch of questions that have been piling up and other things we need to do to complete our session today. So thanks. Please carry on.
Well, we'll be efficient. Thank you. The last thing talks about the idea of the courthouse. This was a 20-year problem, and again, I'm reinforcing the ideas of saying, you know, define the issue of the problem and then explain why. This had been lingering for 20 years since I first came on board. We had an outdated courthouse that indeed had been built in the 1950s, when indeed we had a population of around 60,000, now a population of almost 600,000. It is ill-suited for the kind of work that we have going on there. It is unsafe. In many respects, we have people shackled up going down hallways. It has overly crowded courtrooms. It's a functionally dilapidated building where cracks go all the way up to the top of the building, seven-story building, non-ADA compliant, where we could never get the community to go ahead and invest in these activities overall. We try to point out to people that we had 400,000 visitors a year, and frankly, getting the moral obligation that the cornerstone of democracy really is the rule of law. And how do we go ahead and put that in a proper environment so that your son or daughter is properly adjudicated was part of the issues. We then brought the idea forward, the change in commissioners. We said, let's visualize this building, help us understand what the kind of building you want to have. This is one of the components that came through, a stacking diagram of what we thought it might look like. It didn't end up to be there, but it gave people an idea of what they might be purchasing in the future. We then proposed really a sales tax to accommodate that. Part of the information was cost comparison. Should we go ahead and renovate the old courthouse or build a new one? Cost savings indicated about $161 million savings over a 20-year period. If indeed we built a new courthouse, that was appropriate. And in addition, we had issues dealing with our coroner facility. We are transporting our bodies across county lines to a very antiquated Butler building. We're going to go and provide some resources to make sure that autopsies are done in an appropriate and defensible way. And so we provide that kind of vision as well as to what kind of coroner facility we want to have in the future. So we put those out there. We indicated that a quarter cent sales tax would be necessary to finance this activity and gave people some information of what the fiscal impact might be for that. In this case, about 20 cents over a $100 purchase. And that helped us go ahead and get that measure passed back in November of 2016. We did employ county employees as well to educate and understand the processes going on. And we're very successful in putting that in place. And today, now you see this project is actually under construction. Both this new courthouse as well as the coroner facility being done as well. And so I think that's the third example of trying to reinforce these key points. But I think work in any size environment, define the problem or opportunity, ask the right questions, as I think, you know, Paul and Anthony were talking about. Explain why then before you talk about what and how. Consult with the team involved, the county commissioners, the public, et cetera. Engage them in the process. Allow people to be owners of this activity, as Likert would say. Use the Covey principles. Do your work. There is no easy track record here. You heard that in the previous two presenters as well. It takes hard work all the way down the process, and that's why Collins' idea about hedgehog mentality is so important. Let me, I guess, end up with kind of showing you some resources here. That website connection has all the information about how Johnson County did the campaign for the courthouse. I encourage you to go to that website and pull down all the information, videos, PowerPoint presentations, the whole nine yards is all there. If you've not read these four books, you probably should. The Dealing About Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, Good to Great, Five Dysfunctions of Teams, and Leadership on the Line is what I'd advocate. So I appreciate you letting me take some time here. Final thought is this. Is that, overnight success usually takes 15 years. Don't forget that. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. So let's go to a polling question here. You've heard a number of suggestions from Hannes about things that he would recommend that you consider. Click off as many of these as you think you'd like to follow in the efforts that you undertake to gain support for important projects in your community. While that's happening, I'm going to be pulling all of our presenters back onto the webcams, and we're going to be covering additional questions that have come in and some discussion across our different topics here. You know, one of the things that people are asking about in this is they're really interested in how you navigated some of the state and federal privacy laws when you did your caseworker approach. I guess this would apply to anything. It doesn't have to be caseworker in particular. It could be in a city that maybe doesn't have countywide sort of responsibilities for social services, but yet has sensitive information. How did you navigate through that, and what was your way of doing it? I was very impressed that you were able to do all this in-house using tools at hand.
Yeah, I think the answer is asking the right questions of the attorneys. When we started out this activity, the department heads were the ones most opposed to this activity, and they're saying we can't do it because of HIPAA requirements. And the attorneys come in and said, exactly right, you can't do it, can't share information in an unprotected HIPAA environment. The question I ask is, okay, what can we do? The attorney said, well, they've never been asked that question before. They come back then a few weeks later and say, you know what, it's called the Health Information Portability Act, and there are things you can do to go and share information if indeed they're HIPAA qualified. So we set up a situation where we made those entities, those caseworkers in the various departments that needed to have access to the information, HIPAA qualified. We signed the appropriate documents to kind of share that information, and we're off and running. So I think it's in my experience, it's asking the right question and not being, I think accepting at the first blush what the answer comes back to be. I think attorneys are great at answering a specific question, but are not often very good at trying to work outside the box.
Okay, great. Thank you. That's very helpful. And as we can see from the polling results here, majorities were coming on for many of the topics, especially asking why, educating, and avoiding advocacy, as that's not the professional's role in local government, but the elected officials and the various constituencies. But education is a big thing, and that seemed to factor very strongly in all of our presenters here today. So let me go to some of the questions that are coming up and some of the things that we want to be highlighting here as we conclude. I'll put up the post-webinar discussion questions here, because the most important thing out of these webinars and in all the things we try to do in the ICMA coaching program is really guide people to action. So it's not, you know, it was a great webinar, hope you thought it was, but, you know, what are you going to do with it? And how are you going to apply it? And I think that's really the key and what's critically important as you go forward. I know a lot of questions were coming back, Anthony, for you around the IDO process. In fact, one agency had checked into IDO but found that they were very expensive. And a number of people are asking, hey, is there any way that they could effectively sort of skate off of your experience? And I'm thinking, you know, a lot of local governments do similar processes. You have your own taste and flavor in Gainesville, but what's a good way that people who don't have the budget and such to undertake what you did could further garner, you know, the process, maybe templates for doing things or whatever about your process? Anything you can share there with us, Anthony?
No, nothing. Thank you. Goodbye. No, I think it's a great question. It's something I think about for our entire industry, is scalability. Yeah. For me, you're not a leader unless there's a second and third department of doing, right? So right now we're just we're but this funny group in Gainesville, Florida. And so we absolutely part of what we do is to talk about it and inspire both ourselves and other people to do great work and challenge ourselves to think about things in a different way. And so IDEO was very expensive. It was too expensive for the city, which is why we raised money from the hospital system and the University of Florida and the chamber and on and on and on. It's not something we can afford too many times. So right now, we're trying to build some in-house talent, training people on some of these principles, bringing in additional resources if needed. And then what we learned from that experience, continuing on to do with other departments. And absolutely, if others are interested in trying to model what they do in whole or in part of what we have done, then we are absolutely willing and able to help that and help scale that to other cities as needed. There's some very simple things to do, and there's some not so simple things to do, but people can take and steal all the things that we have and replicate it as they wish, and we'd be happy to help them do that.
Okay, and again, as I've invited each of the presenters to do, and Hannes, you provided that with your example with the courthouse and all the collaterals and everything else that you did in launching that campaign. We'll ask Paul to shoot that over his link before the day's out, and as well with you, Anthony, and I'll try to get that out to people so they can at least do a first cut on their own about, you know, what's available and what questions they might have and everything else, so that'll be useful to them. We do have lots of resources, and some of you have asked, oh, geez, I got distracted today. I couldn't pay total attention. We do have digital recordings of this. I hope that you'll share the digital recordings. You go to the webinar archives right here at icma.org/coaching. The webinar archives, and you can share this with other people in your organization. If you get two or three or four or more people with you in your organization thinking about this, you start to get critical mass. I'm interested, you know, Paul and Anthony and Hannes, when you were first working on organizing these different initiatives that you did, what was sort of the critical mass size of people that you found you needed to sort of draw in as the kernel to start with? Just quickly, just so people get a sense of, okay, hey, how many buddies do I need to have, you know, to get something moving? Paul, why don't you start?
You know, it's interesting. We started with our whole executive management team because the need for infrastructure kind of went across all departments. And so I'm kind of a believer of getting your think tank together, which should be your executive management team, and start with that. Certainly appeals often where your public works department takes a lead, great staff support out of my office here at the city administrator's office to kind of be the focal point. But you kind of need the key players from different departments when you're looking at something like WeWork from an infrastructure standpoint.
What was your critical mass to start with in your Skunk Works, Anthony?
It's a good question. I think the easy answer for us, is sometimes I tell my staff, it is one by one, W-O-N by O-N-E. And so it literally takes a person talking to a person talking to a person. It does not work in large group settings, I don't think. Executive management team, that is absolutely the case. But more importantly, finding people that are ready for change, finding people that are ready to think, finding people that are ready to do, can come in unexpected ways. And too often we think of the same folks doing work. And you may decide to reach out across the organization or across industry or across neighborhoods to find people that have a similar kind of thought process. You may be intrigued and curious to find that people that you just did not expect would come on board and add value would. And so I look for that anywhere, both in talent we hire and in people across the organization or across the country that have similar thinking. But one by one, W-O-N by O-N-E.
That's a great aphorism. Just before we go to Hannes here, I just want to highlight for people, I put a polling question up here at the end. We always like to get some instant feedback from you about the value of the webinar. If you would click off as many items as you or your agency gained value from in today's session, that would be great. We'd like to get a good response from all of you that are on the webinar here today. So, Hannes, how about you? What was the critical mass? How did you get things rolling in your organization to make a difference and to get that kernel to start?
I think that Anthony's correct. It's one by one. I like the acronym that he put out there. I think it is scalable given the situation. With regards to the Caseworker Resource Center, it was the department heads of those departments that I had to enfranchise and get on board and have discussions and difficult conversations about as well. With regards to the cultural change, it was all the executive leadership team. All 32 individuals had to be part of that concept because we are not rich enough to not have additional resources. It takes time. And on the courthouse, we had to enfranchise the department heads as well as the other elected officials, the judges, the user groups as well, key user groups. So I think managers are smart enough to figure out who those key folks are, but you need to have a team. This is not a solo act, and allowing other people to be part of the process is critical.
Okay. One of the things that, and I'm going to share the results here, we can see that people got benefits from many of the areas that we're seeking to deliver from today's session. So thank you, presenters, for a great job. One of the questions that's coming up is, how do you get support from the public at large when the benefits may not be reaching all the people in the public? In other words, how do you get people to think bigger for the benefit of the community as a whole versus, you know, well, what's in it for me? I don't have kids in school, or I don't have, you know, my street's fine, or whatever else that might cause people to think small. How do you get them to think bigger about what is needed and why they should support it? Just a quick response for one or two of you, if you could.
And I'll jump in real quick. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll go real quick. In Santa Barbara, we went on civic pride that we need to reinvest in Santa Barbara. We need a generational reinvestment in Santa Barbara. There's a lot of civic history of the community stepping up over the years, going back a century. And so it was kind of, this is our turn to do what's right for the city. And I think that played.
Yeah, and I think for Johnson County, we really leaned on the idea of good civics, the idea that you may not use the courthouse, but as a foundation of our democracy, rule of law is important. That really kind of swayed some people.
Okay. I think for Gainesville, it's actually just the opposite. It may be to think smaller sometimes. It may be a big idea, but it's actually these very small moments of truth and interactions that people really think and care about. It's and that's how I think we can grab them when they understand how it relates to them as an individual, not in a very large way.
Hmm. that's an interesting idea, especially with your whole Department of Doing idea and everything. You're changing how you're relating to people, and people see that relationship changing, even if they're not the immediate beneficiary. They could see, okay, this is I see how this is changing the way my community is engaging, and that could be supportive. So we've got the contact information here for our presenters. I am going to include in the follow-up email sending out later today the links that I'm getting from our presenters to help share with you. And let me just go very quickly around the horn in our last moment here. Maybe a word or a phrase. We'll start with you, Paul, and then go to Anthony, and then to Hannes, a word or phrase that you'd like to leave your this audience with today. We really appreciate your extraordinary work. So, Paul, if you would.
Persistence.
Anthony.
I will say, when IDEO left, the very last email I got from them was, orchestrate the crowd.
Right. Honest.
I think the idea being that leadership is difficult. Again, overnight success usually takes 15 years, but what joy you will have in the success.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Well, I want to thank our presenters today, Paul Casey, City Manager in Santa Barbara, California, Anthony Lyons, City Manager in Gainesville, Florida, and Hannes Zacharias, now Professor of Practice at University of Kansas, for their great presentations and all the work they did in preparing this webinar with me today. Again, a PDF of the PowerPoints and results of the polling questions and the links that I'll be getting from our presenters will be included in an email that you'll receive within 24 hours so that you can be tapping and sharing these resources with others. Please complete the survey after the webinar. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. And thank you all for joining us today and for all that you do to thrive in local government and to help your communities thrive by the good work that you do. So this is Don Maruska on behalf of the ICMA coaching program, thanking you all for being here today. Have a great day.